This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. The staff of the Trumpet are excited to be hosting a special guest at our offices very soon. On May 7th, British journalist, broadcaster, and author Melanie Phillips will be visiting our offices here in Edmond, Oklahoma. She'll be giving a lecture at Armstrong Auditorium at 6 p.m. that evening. It's free. It's open to the public. She'll be sharing her insights about some of today's turbulent world conditions. I really want to encourage you to come if you can, but even if you can't, we will be live streaming the event. You can watch for details about that on thetrumpet.com. But we are dedicating the program today to an interview that I did with her on Monday in anticipation of her event here. She agreed to a 15-minute interview, and we ended up talking for well over 40 minutes. She kept on talking even after we stopped taping. She has a lot on her mind. I think you'll find it very fascinating to listen to her. Melanie Phillips is a fighter. She is a passionate champion of facts. She was once a card-carrying member of the political left in Britain, but then bit by bit, on issue after issue, she followed the facts, and those facts led her to very different conclusions than those of her colleagues. And she recognized that in a lot of cases, they were allowing ideology to take precedent. They were actually stifling facts and denying facts that undermined their own assumptions. And you're going to hear her talk quite a bit about that in this interview. What she doesn't talk a whole lot about is just how much trouble it got her in when she simply stood up for what she had proved to be true, when it differed from the leftist orthodoxy that was governing the papers that she worked for. Melanie has defended simple, basic, common sense truths like the fact that children are best served by growing up in a two-parent family. That's what the evidence proves, and it's evidence that a lot of people vehemently deny. She's defended basic facts like there are radical Muslims that want to destroy the West, and we have to defend Western culture and values if we want to survive. She's defended facts like there's only one functional Western-style democracy in the Middle East, and it is an ally that we need to defend. That is Israel. Over and over, Melanie has sought out the facts about these issues, and then she has stated them. She stated them plainly. For this, she is routinely criticized and lambasted. In her newest book, it's a memoir called Guardian Angel, she documents some of the comments that she has received over the years. I'm just going to read a couple of paragraphs to you from this book. She says, a few examples chosen pretty well at random. The routinely insane Melanie Phillips, that's from The Times. Spoof columnist, that's what The Guardian said about her. One of the Mail's routine monsters, from The Independent. The Guardian called her the Daily Mail's queen of mean. The Guardian called her the simplistic authoritarian commentator, Melanie Phillips. The Guardian criticized the depths of ignorance and bigotry that can scarcely have been matched even in the Mail. One independent commentator said, consider the rightward and increasingly scary trajectory of, ooh, shall we say, Melanie Phillips, who started out as a Guardian herbivore and now, like Bertie Wooster's Aunt Agatha, eats broken bottles and kills rats with her teeth. That's pretty remarkable criticism. I'm thinking if you get that kind of criticism from the likes of the people that are issuing these criticisms, it's a pretty good indication you're doing something right. One thing that people criticize her for is for being so sure of herself. And she responds with this. This is also from her book. For sure, sometimes I have got it wrong. After all, since I did come to the conclusion that my entire worldview in my early years was wrong, I can scarcely be accused of never changing my mind. But without wishing to sound boastful, I believe that on issue after issue, where the evidence is now finally in on education, family breakdown, multiculturalism, human rights law, the European Union, the effects of cannabis, and yes, man-made global warming, I have been proved right. And then she says, there is also another side effect of enduring so much abuse. Eventually, the insults start losing their power. Once you have been called reactionary, right-wing, far-right, extreme-right, ultra-right, fascist, racist, Nazi, Holocaust shroud waver, warmonger, insane, and an extreme right-wing, insane, racist, warmongering, Holocaust shroud waving Jew, just what else can they throw at you? Before we get to the interview, I'll read one more quote from her book. She says this in another interview with The Guardian. In 2006, following publication of my book, Londonistan, which charted Britain's capitulation to Islamist aggression, I might add, it's an excellent book, demonstrated the unbridgeable chasm between myself and the left. Jackie Ashley, the interviewer, found that my, quote, hysterical tone repels frank and thoughtful argument. Indeed, it was like interviewing a human cactus. Well, I had a very different experience in talking with Melanie. She's hardly a human cactus. We are really looking forward to hosting her here in Edmond, Oklahoma on May 7th, 6 p.m. in Armstrong Auditorium. Everyone is free to attend. There's no cost. There's open seating. If you want more information, you can visit thetrumpet.com. You can get directions to the venue. We are also going to be live streaming this lecture. If you can't make it in person, you can keep your eyes on the website for information about that. Again, visit thetrumpet.com. So now to the interview. We talked in this interview about her unique political journey. It's quite a fascinating story, how she came to view the world the way that she does, some of the issues that she's had, run-ins with those on the political left, why society today is succumbing to a spirit of irrationality. And I even got her thoughts on the French election from this past Sunday. And I'm going to conclude the program by reading a little bit more of this most recent book of hers called Guardian Angel. So we will now run the tape of my interview this past Monday with British journalist Melanie Phillips. British journalist Melanie Phillips is familiar to longtime Trumpet readers. We've referred to her and quoted her many times over the years. She has excellent insights into British politics and social issues, as well as matters related to Israel and the Middle East, the threat of militant Islam, and other global concerns. In anticipation of her upcoming public lecture in Edmond, Oklahoma, she's agreed to join us for a bit of discussion. We have her here via Skype. Hello, Melanie.
Hello, Joe.
So I'd like to just start by talking about some of your history as a journalist. You got your first big break with The Guardian. This British paper has a long, distinguished history of independent journalism and is being liberal in the traditional sense of the term liberal. But over your time there, you said you saw it change into a different kind of liberalism, along with changes in British society more broadly. Can you just tell us about your experiences there and what you noticed?
Yes, I consider myself, and can certainly then considered myself, to be a traditional liberal, in the sense of believing in tolerance and in improving the lot of my fellow humans, but not left-wing. And I drew a distinction between the two. And what I hadn't realized, that even by the time I joined The Guardian, which was the very late 1970s, liberal society in Britain, traditional liberal society, had become left-wing. The two had kind of fused. And The Guardian had become a left-wing paper. And I had assumed that it was a liberal paper, believing in tolerance and open mind and encouraging a difference in view. And to my horror and astonishment, I discovered that only one view was permitted, which was what we would now call political correctness, but it wasn't called that then. And I'm an old-fashioned journalist, and I was trained in an old-fashioned way to pay careful attention to evidence and to facts, and only to draw conclusions from what was available in terms of evidence and facts. And while I don't think any of us would ever claim to have the truth, we told the truth as far as we could see it. We adduced evidence. We were careful to be as accurate as we possibly could. We believed in the difference between truth and lies. That was old-fashioned journalism. And I saw that change because I saw the whole intellectual basis of the West change during, I would say, the 1970s and the 1980s. The whole idea of objective truth went out the window. In came moral and cultural relativism. Everything was a narrative. Everything was merely a matter of opinion. What was right morally was what was right for me. My values couldn't be considered to be any better or worse than anyone else's. No one could tell me that my lifestyle was better or worse than anyone else's. And journalists started to pay much less attention to the distinction between evidence and opinion. And all of these things I charted, and I was a social policy writer. I was wholly concerned with domestic issues such as education, family matters, issues of national identity, really. And I saw all those become hijacked by the left. And they became the antithesis of what I thought they were all about. So whereas, for example, family breakdown, it seemed to me, was a sometimes unavoidable tragedy or hardship or disadvantage, it became a matter of women's rights to bring up a child without a father. I thought it was best avoided where possible. It wasn't always possible, but best avoided if possible for everyone's benefit. And I was told that that was old-fashioned, Old Testament fundamentalism. In education, I watched the dismantling of the teaching of British and Western history on the basis that the West was innately bad because it was innately capitalist and colonialist. And consequently, the very idea of education being the transmission of a society's values down through the generations, that's what education actually is. In the West, that became a form of racism. You couldn't teach British history. You couldn't teach Western values. You had to teach that everyone's values were the same as everyone else's. And it seemed to me at the time that this meant that liberal society, old-fashioned liberal society, believing in freedom, personal and individual liberty, the equality, the dignity of every human being, tolerance and all that, you couldn't uphold that over societies which didn't have those things. And so issue by issue, I just looked at the evidence and wrote what I found. And I realized during the 80s that all my friends and colleagues at The Guardian and on the left had departed from me. They simply would not tolerate any point of view other than their own.
This journey that you're talking about, it ended up taking you into Israeli politics and more broad global concerns. You mentioned, though, that you started with social issues and you started with family within British society. Can you just tell us a little bit about maybe some of those earlier battles that you faced as you were recognizing, say, the advantage of a child growing up within a family with two parents, that type of thing, and how that ended up coming to at loggerheads with some of those who said, well, no, that's actually not in the best advantage of the child?
Well, the family issue was particularly bitter because people took it personally. I didn't mean it personally. I was not making any value judgments about individuals' backgrounds. I was talking always and writing always about matters of public policy, about generalities. And it seemed to me from all the evidence, and at the time, I'm talking now about the early to mid 80s, mid 80s onwards and early 90s. And there was a lot of research that was being done into the effect, the impact of divorce. It was then all about divorce. And it was obvious to me that the evidence was absolutely overwhelming, that relatively speaking, by and large, children were not well served when their parents divorced. Now, this was complicated. There are obviously situations where the relationship between the parents was so bad, it was better for the child if the parents separated. But by and large, most divorcing couples weren't in that category. It was more a kind of grumbling unhappiness. And in those circumstances, the child was actually better off if the parents stayed together. That's what the evidence showed. And it then seemed to me that social scientists were beginning to skew the evidence. These were academics who were supposedly the gold standard of truth and evidence. And they were basically skewing their own research to arrive at the conclusion that was convenient to them. And by them, I mean personally to them, because many of them were divorced or divorcing or in irregular relationships. And they wanted their research to validate what they were doing and to give them a clean conscience about their children. And those academics that didn't do that, that remained true to the evidence and retained their integrity as researchers, I saw them persecuted and pilloried. Their grant money was removed. They became social and professional pariahs within their own discipline because they dared to tell the truth. And I realized then that something really dreadful was going on in terms of the corruption of social science and the corruption of public debate. On a personal level, people took it very personally. I lost friends and colleagues. Well, I lost friends and colleagues throughout this entire process because they regarded me as having become right-wing, and that was a sort of thought crime. Because, you know, to be right-wing was become sort of be in league with the devil almost. But the family thing was very bitter because they couldn't bear the fact that the evidence said what it said and they wanted to pretend it didn't. And that was only one of many, many issues. I worked through them, as I say, family, education. And then the whole business of multiculturalism came up, that you couldn't assert the superior value of British and Western ethics, morals, characteristics, values over countries which didn't enjoy equality for women, freedom of conscience, freedom of speech. You couldn't say that. And this seemed to me absolutely perverse. And it became absolutely clear to me that what was being dismantled was the whole framework of Western civilized values. The normative value of the family was being dismantled. The purpose of education, transmitting a culture down through the generations, was being dismantled. The very idea of Western identity, that Britain or Western countries, that you had a right to assert your own identity and culture, and to say it was actually better than others, that was deemed now to be a form of racism. And so that was multiculturalism. And then we progressed over the, you know, over scroll on a few years, we get to the whole business of Islamism. And then it became even more explosive, literally explosive, because then journalists feared, without some considerable force behind it, that they would actually be killed if they told the truth about Islamic radicalism, and indeed if they talked about Islam at all. And so I waded into that, and consequently I was called every kind of phobe and bigot and, you know, racist, sexist, homophobic, Islamophobic. I mean, you know, I've been through all the phobias.
Right.
It was clear to me that debate in the West was being shut down. The exercise of reason was basically being undermined completely. You could not adduce evidence and say, well, actually, these are the facts and they don't correspond to your ideological view of the world. You couldn't say that without having a label hung around your neck that basically warned people to have nothing to do with you because you were some kind of evil person.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG. This is an interview we did with British journalist and author Melanie Phillips. Melanie will be visiting our offices here in Edmond, Oklahoma on Sunday, May 7th. She's going to be giving a public lecture at 6 p.m. that evening. We'd love to have you join us. You can look for information on how to attend in person or to live stream the event online by visiting thetrumpet.com. We're going to hear more of this interview when we come back after a short break.
is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
I'm Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. We're giving you an interview with Melanie Phillips, British journalist. She spoke to us this past Monday, and we were talking about how the left in Britain undermines the traditional family. I was asking her about why, in her view, they are so hostile to something that seems so self-evidently good, and we're just going to break into the interview with more of her answer.
To go back to the family for a moment, much of that argument was driven by feminism, by radical feminism. Not the kind of feminism which wants women just to have an equal shot at working and all that, but the kind of feminism that says men are innately disgusting and we are better off without them. There was one tract published around this time by a very prominent, at the time, campaigner for women's issues. I mean, she was prominent because she was lionized by the whole political class. You know, she was very well established. And she produced this pamphlet, which was entitled, "Would You Take One Home With You?" Hmm. And she was referring to men. It was that was going on so much in the family. And as a result of that, it became a woman's right to have a child without a man. And consequently, what had been considered a disadvantage, a child brought up without a father, became something which you couldn't gainsay at all. And a whole structure grew up in Britain in which women were incentivized and rewarded for having children, first of all, out of wedlock, and then they were, you know, cohabiting, and those all broke down. And you had a whole financial system of incentives and a complete collapse of all the kind of informal social constraints that once held the traditional family together. And that happened over many years. And the result is that we now have in Britain whole communities where there are children who are brought up by one, two, three, four, five generations of women only, and who have no idea what a committed father is. And so there is no prospect of those children ever being able to form a family unit which will be of benefit to them and to their children. And this is a great tragedy that's happened. So that was the family. In terms of national identity, what drove people was entirely ideological. It was the belief that the West was basically bad. That the West was responsible for all the ills of the world, that the Western nation gave rise to nationalism, and that Western nationalism gave rise to exclusion of the other, exclusion of people who weren't born into the West, weren't born into Britain. And consequently, the Western nation was responsible for prejudice, bigotry, and war. Now, when you look around the world, you know, you see many nations in the developing world which are truly bigoted and which exclude people and do terrible things to their own people, let alone anybody else. And yet these were given a completely free pass. And this is how that worked, that because the West was innately bad, it was not capable of being a victim ever. Because it was all powerful. Capitalism made it all powerful. So if you were powerful, you could never be a victim. The capitalist West, being all powerful, had victimized the developing world. The developing world was the victim of the First World, the victim of America, the victim of the West. And consequently, if the developing world did bad things to the First World, to America, to the West, the developing world could not be held responsible for its actions. It had to be the fault of the West for having provoked it. And so you had the truly dreadful situation when 9/11 happened in America. You had people in Britain saying America had it coming to it. Why? It had to have it coming to it. America could not be the victim of the developing world. That was just impossible. And so that lay behind the undermining of Western national identity, this idea that the West was innately bad, that Western nationalism was bad, and that in order to remove the threat posed forever and for all time by Western nationalism, You had to remove the nation. You had to basically undermine the nation. And instead of the nation, which was the embodiment of the particular, a particular nation resting on a particular history, its own language, its own historic religion, its own institutions, its own traditions. Instead of the particular, you had the universal. The universal was good, the particular was bad. So while the nation was bad, then transnational institutions and laws were good. So, for example, you had the whole development of international human rights law. Now, human rights are very important, but what international human rights law did was it removed human rights from its traditional anchorage in a sense of duty to others, putting others first, from which rights derive. It got rid of duty altogether, and it simply erected rights as a kind of edifice. And it made them universal so that you couldn't gainsay them, because universal trumped the particular. So in Britain, although the British Parliament remains sovereign, at any one stage it could have said, we're not going to remain signed up to human rights law. We will take ourselves away from the European Convention on Human Rights. To that extent, Parliament remains sovereign. But nevertheless, while it was signed up to human rights law, international human rights law, it kind of performed a kind of self-denying ordinance, in that English law had to correspond to human rights law. And consequently, people in Britain found that they could no longer do stuff like, in their own interests, like deport people who posed an active threat to the security and well-being of British citizens. Why couldn't they deport them? Because the English courts said that according to international human rights law, you had to protect these people's family life, they had an equal right to welfare benefits, and so on and so on. And these are many other ways. In many other ways, people found that their ability to be in a self-governing nation was being constantly eroded. And the reason for all that, and it lies behind the European Union and all that's followed from all of that, the reason for all that fundamentally is the belief that the Western nation is the source of all bad things in the world.
Yeah, you in all of these instances that you're describing, you are talking about the preponderance of evidence pointing to one particular conclusion, like, say, you have multiple generations of women raising children, and you see this dysfunction kind of entrenched within British society more and more, and the evidence shows this isn't helping these kids. It's turning them more and more, making them more and more dependent on the government, and so on. You've seen how many problems British society has had because of exactly the kinds of policies that you're saying. So it's policy flying in the face of evidence. And you really have, I mean, you talked early on about just how it's pursuing the facts wherever they may lead, that your role as a journalist is to follow the evidence wherever it leads. And you're kind of fighting the tempest here against what seems to be this almost inexorable movement toward the irrational.
Well, there is a reason for that, in my view, and I expounded on this in one of my books, The World Turned Upside Down.
Yes.
Because eventually, after many years of battling with one issue after another, I kind of started putting it all together, because I realized that it wasn't just one issue after another. There was a pattern and there was an explanation. And the explanation is basically that what links all these things and produces the phenomenon you're talking about, the eclipse of reason, is that what we're dealing with over a wide number of issues is ideology. Now, ideology is, I would say, a doctrinal attachment to an idea. The attachment is so deep and so absolute. The attachment to the idea is so deep and so absolute, it cannot be gainsaid. It's a bit like religious fanaticism without the religion. And indeed, ideology came in my view, into the West, and particularly in Britain, which, unlike America, became very much more quickly a very secularized society, where religion was sort of driven really quite out of public discourse. So instead of religious fanaticism, you have kind of secular fanaticism, in which the governing idea, just like, you know, religiosity of old, it couldn't brook any opposition. You know, the medieval Catholic Church couldn't brook any opposition, and it regarded any deviation from the orthodoxy as heresy, and it burned heretics at the stake. So we have a secular equivalent of that, in that the governing idea is all important. Now, whether the governing idea is deep green environmentalism, whether it's scientism or materialism, the idea that there is nothing beyond the material universe, and anything that anyone who says that there is basically either mad or a charlatan. Feminism, the idea that, you know, women basically must slough off, must get rid of the patriarchy. Multiculturalism, the idea that no one culture is better than any others, and certainly the West is worse than all the others. Anti-racism, there's a whole variety, a whole number of these isms, which are all ideologies. The idea, the power of the idea, drives all before it. It cannot be gainsaid. Now, why is that? Because all these ideas are based on the belief that they all serve to perfect the world. It is really a kind of it's a secularized religious fanaticism. Mm-hmm. Just as medieval religious people in Europe believed that, you know, the apocalypse was about to come. They were millenarians. They believed that the perfection of the world was about to happen, and nothing could be done to prevent the perfection of the world. So this is the secular equivalent. If you don't believe in man-made global warming, then you are a climate change denier. You are an evil person on a par with Holocaust denial. Why? Because you are personally going to help consign the planet to oblivion. It's as bad as that. If you are against multiculturalism, you are against the perfection of the world in driving out prejudice from the human heart. People believe that that is actually possible. If you get rid of the idea that the West is best, then you can have the eradication of all prejudice and bigotry. I mean, I think it's crazy, but nevertheless, the power of the idea is based on the fact that there can be no opposition to it, because it's not just an idea, it is the embodiment of virtue. And so anyone who gainsays, anyone who opposes that idea, doesn't just come with a set of views which you may disagree with, you may argue with. There can be no argument, because by gainsaying, by standing against the very idea of virtue, you are innately a bad and evil person, and there can be no discussion with you. You have to be shut down. So it's a formula for a most illiberal and oppressive attitude. It's the opposite of an open mind. And even more fundamentally, it completely denies the efficacy and the necessity for the exercise of reason. Because if you cannot produce evidence based on demonstrable facts to say, actually, here are facts. They show that this idea is actually inaccurate. It's based on a falsehood. It's untrue or whatever. If you can't adduce evidence, then you can't use reason. If you don't believe that there is such a thing as truth, then you cannot use reason in the employ of that truth. And so reason goes out the window. So this is what we are living through. We're living through we're supposed to be, the most rational age ever known to mankind. We are most intelligent, we are most rational, and in fact, we've become completely irrational, anti-rational. We shut down argument now all the time on the basis that the idea is sanctified and cannot be opposed without the person who's opposing it being basically tied to a metaphorical stake. And professionally, if not burned alive, professionally and socially ostracized.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG. This is an interview we did with British journalist and author Melanie Phillips. She spoke with us in advance of a visit she'll be making to Edmond, Oklahoma on Sunday, May 7th. She's going to be giving a public lecture at 6 p.m. that evening. Go online to thetrumpet.com for information on how to attend in person or to live stream the event. We finished the interview getting her thoughts on this past Sunday's election in France. We're going to hear that right after a short break.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Let's go straight to the final segment of the interview we did with British journalist Melanie Phillips from this past Monday. You're going to be traveling to the United States here in just a couple of days and beginning to talk to some audiences, yeah, including the one in Edmond, Oklahoma that we're going to be sponsoring. We're really looking forward to hearing you. I wanted to just give you at least a little bit of a chance as we finish to tell us what your thoughts were. Obviously, you followed the vote in France this last weekend. This is part of a broad trend that we're seeing in a lot of European nations. And a lot of people maybe put this together with what happened with Britain leaving the European Union. What is your take on what's happening in France?
Yes, well, it's part of a trend that I will be talking about, I think, a lot to disparate audiences around America. I should be going all over the place, California, your own venue in Oklahoma, which I'm looking forward to enormously, Minnesota, Iowa, New York. And what I'm looking at in particular, and what people are very interested, I think, in hearing about, is the pattern that certainly I and many others can see between what happened in Britain over Brexit, the election of Donald Trump, and the convulsions that are happening now in France and in Europe. And I think it's very important, you know, someone like Donald Trump is obviously a very divisive figure, but I think it's very important, if one can, to separate out the man from what he represents, and to separate out some of these figures in Europe from what they represent, because it's what they represent that interests me, that is so important, because I do think we're at a kind of tipping point here, where you have literally millions of people in Britain, in mainland Europe, and in America, who have looked at the status quo, the political and cultural status quo, and said to themselves at some level, things are going very, very badly wrong. It's not simply a question of being governed by fools or charlatans or people we don't like. There is something fundamental that's gone wrong here with our society and our civilization. And indeed, our civilization is in danger. And it takes different forms in different places. Britain is different from mainland Europe. Mainland Europe is different, again, from America. But that's fundamentally what's been going on. And the people have finally found a voice and a way of expressing themselves. It started with Brexit. I wasn't surprised when Brexit happened because I've been tracking the fury of a population which has felt for years that its concerns and the way it just looks at the world have been completely both ignored, dismissed, and vilified by the entire political and intellectual establishment. And basically, that's what Brexit was about.
And that's really what Donald Trump's election was so much about in the United States. Very similar.
Absolutely. People have just had enough of having their concerns dismissed and being barracked and pilloried for wanting to stand up for what for them is basic, their basic entitlement to live in a country that they can call home, to govern themselves in that country, to be able to identify with like-minded people in that homeland around a set of values and traditions and history and institutions which they all share, to want to defend that homeland against threats from both within and without, and to be led by people who all agree in that shared national project. And they all agree that there are big threats from outside to that national project. Mm-hmm. Now, these things all take different forms, as I say, but that's basically what it's all about. And that's what's been happening in France. You have a situation now where, you know, you have this phenomenon of Marine Le Pen. Now, people have said, you know, that all kinds of people in Europe and in Trump in America, and people who supported Brexit. They're variously fascistic. They are xenophobic. They are prejudiced. They are bigots. They are people who don't value democracy. None of that is true for the vast majority of these politicians, actually. All they want is actually the opposite. They want to have a real democracy based on the freedom to govern themselves in accordance with their own values. And that, to me, is the opposite of fascism. But with Marine Le Pen, you've got something that is actually quite near to that description. She has gone to some lengths to sanitize herself, to distance herself from her father. She even threw him out of the party. In my view, she's done that not for reasons of principle, but in order to gain power. I think she's very dangerous. But the reason she has come to the position she's come to, she could now become president of France. Everyone thinks that she should be beaten in the second round, but we live in such unpredictable times. Mm-hmm. Who knows? You have, some 40%, 41, more than 41% of the French. If you look at how they all voted for all these candidates, right, you can say that more than 41% of the French electorate wanted the toughest possible measures against Islamic extremism. Mm-hmm. And they also wanted goodbye to the EU. That's a lot of people, 41%. And so you've got to factor that into this second round. So the only reason Marine Le Pen, who I do regard as a dangerous figure, I don't think she's a Democrat. I do think she has fascistic overtones. Her program corresponds to me to National Socialism, to the national bit and to the socialism bit, which of course, National Socialism was a Nazi party. Mm-hmm. So I think she's dangerous. The reason she is in now the powerful position she's in is because the French people have simply been abandoned by their entire political establishment, who have progressively eroded the French national identity, their ability to govern themselves, and has imported or not dealt with a whole set of Islamic radicals who will not assimilate into France and who want France to assimilate to them. And they are violent, and they are making the French lives a misery. If you are a Jew in France now, many Jews have left to go and live in Israel because it is simply too dangerous to be a Jew in France. That is an amazing situation. And that is what Le Pen has benefited from, because the entire political class has refused to even acknowledge these things. So she's now up against this man, Emmanuel Macron. He has apparently come from nowhere. Well, I don't believe people come from nowhere, actually. I believe everyone comes from somewhere, and nobody comes from nothing. And somebody is behind him. Somebody has put up the money to enable him to communicate with the masses. Anyway, he's a phenomenon because he doesn't come from the established left or right. And he has posed as the kind of populist champion. He's posed as the outsider. He's trying to take advantage of this great populist upswing. He's not an outsider at all. He is the classic insider. He is what the French call an énarque. He is a graduate of the super elite École Nationale d'Administration, which provides the most senior intellectual French member of the civil service. He became a senior civil servant. He went to work for Rothschild's bank. He made a lot of money. He came back as, I think, the deputy director of the Élysée. He was a very senior guy in the heart of the establishment. So who's he kidding? And he's a passionate Europhile. He believes in more integration of Europe. He believes, in a further erosion of French self-government. And he doesn't believe that Islam, the religion of Islam, has anything to do with Islamic extremism. He believes Daesh, he's on record saying Daesh is not Islam. There is no problem of Islam in France, none. The problem of Islamic extremism is nothing to do with the religion. It's simply a set of ideas that have been foisted upon Islamic believers. I mean, it's complete nonsense. So you've got now a choice. A choice between, in my view, extremes. Macron is being regarded as a centrist. If I read again that he's a centrist, I think I shall throw the newspaper around the room. He's not a centrist. He is somebody who believes in the erosion of French self-government, and he believes in appeasement of and a denial of and appeasement of radical Islamic extremism. How can that possibly be a centrist position? So you've got the French now in a nightmare situation, mm-hmm. having to choose now in the runoff in a couple of weeks' time between two extremes. The extreme globalist internationalist Macron, who would basically further undermine French self-government and independence and further undermine its defense against Islamism, versus Mrs. Madame Le Pen, who is against the EU and against Islamism, but also, in my view, is against democracy. What a choice. Mm-hmm. What a choice. And if Macron, as is being predicted, becomes president, and I don't think it's a foregone conclusion, but if he becomes president, the idea that we can all, everyone will sort of breathe a sigh of relief and say, well, that problem's now gone away is wrong. Because I'm sure that what Madame Le Pen has in her mind is that if Macron becomes president, the forces that have propelled her to the position she has now reached are going to increase, because the problems are going to mount up from both the erosion of democracy through the EU integration and the problem of radical Islam not being confronted. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure she'll be banking on that bringing her to power at the next presidential election. So, you know, France will not be out of the woods at all. It's a really serious situation in France, in my view.
Well, it's stunning to watch. You can definitely understand the forces that are propelling these individuals into power. You were mentioning in America, in Britain, these game-changing situations happening here, and seeing it play out, the solutions that these individual populations are reaching for in order to address these nation-destroying problems. Really, that's where the question is. What is going to happen in each of these situations as people cry out for solutions? And what's happening in France is a good sign of just how dangerous it can be when we're somewhat of a backed into a corner like we are. Well, we've been talking with British journalist, broadcaster, and author Melanie Phillips. She is going to be visiting the Trumpet offices in Edmond, Oklahoma on May 7th. Come visit if you're in the area. She's giving a public lecture at 6 p.m. that Sunday night, or you can watch thetrumpet.com for details on how to live stream the event. She's very wonderful to talk with you, Melanie. I don't know how you're going to fit it all into an hour in the discussion.
Indeed. Just one further thought, if any of your listeners are interested. If anyone's interested in following my work and indeed following my progress around America, then everybody can access my website, which is melaniephillips.com, where I archive and enter all my published work, all my broadcasting activities, all my lectures and speaking engagements, as well as writing blog posts about, I've just written one today, in fact, about the French election, melaniephillips.com. So if anyone's interested, please do follow me there.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you so much for talking to me. I look forward to seeing you in Edmond.
For the last word of the program today, I just want to read a few paragraphs from toward the end of Melanie Phillips' memoir called Guardian Angel. She's talking about an interview that she gave with The Guardian in 2006 after publishing her book Londonistan. And she says that there was something very shocking about this interview. She said, expressing exasperated disbelief at my description of, quote, a debauched and disorderly culture of instant gratification with disintegrating families, feral children and violence, squalor and vulgarity on the streets. She, this Guardian interviewer, waved her hand dismissively at the window and said, I see no feral children. Where are they? We were sitting in a cafe in Chiswick, one of the most chic and well-to-do areas of London. Of course, there were no feral children there, I said in astonishment. But in deprived and shattered communities, in the north of England, for example, there were veritable cultural deserts where committed fathers were simply unknown, and children who knew nothing but abandonment, disorder, and violence were indeed not just wild and undisciplined, but lacked the basic connection to a civilized society. How could Ashley, a Guardian journalist, not know that there were now two Britons, one that was part of society and another that had largely detached itself from it? How could such misguided complacency possibly be considered progressive? Why, though, was I so taken aback? I surely knew the Guardian mindset by now. I am always shocked, however, by the sheer scale of the disconnect between left-wingers and reality. I am always shocked by the sheer impossibility of getting them to see what is actually in front of their eyes. Indeed, it is terrifying, for it means that they are simply impervious to reason. It means that the West will always harbor those who will repeat the horrors of the past. And that means sliding into primitivism and chaos. Those of us who live by the verbal sword must accept that we have chosen to inhabit the world of intellectual combat and not be too surprised by the missiles that are hurled our way. But I believe that what has happened to me illustrates what has happened to British society and Western culture during the past three decades. It helps explain what is otherwise very hard to understand and bewilders so many that our cultural and political elites have simply turned truth and justice inside out, and that with argument replaced by insult and abuse, taken leave of reality itself. I believe that the left has suborned the center ground by hijacking the language of morality, virtue, and progress, and that all these urgently need to be reclaimed for the true center ground. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I really want to thank my guest, Melanie Phillips, and thanks also to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Ms. Phillips. The family is the issue of issues because the traditional family embodies the idea that there is something beyond the selfish individual. It is thus a sacred institution. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.